Okay, everybody, on that very conciliatory note, having decided on the lighting, welcome. We're a very lucky audience tonight, and I should have the book in hand. I am astonished that this is selling for £16.50 after the event. Christmas on its way, but never a greater bargain was struck. So in preparation for what is to follow, I'd ask you please to switch your phones to silent, fasten your seatbelts, affix your gender lenses. The hashtag for this evening as well, and I'm very new to Twitter, but is hashtag, you'll see, LSEWPS. So my name's Devika Hovell. I'm in the Department of Law here at the LSE. I've got the pleasure of welcoming you on behalf of the Centre for Women, Peace and Security, of course, a sparkling new centre established in 2015 with our director, Professor Christine Chinkin, up the back and acknowledging the support of the Preventing Sexual Violence in Conflict initiative. We're here, though, of course, to discuss this amazing bargain, this incredible book, The Politics of Gender Justice at the International Criminal Court, written, of course, by Louise Chappell, a professor in political science, and I beg your pardon, I've lost my place. I know you're at the University of New South Wales, professor in political sciences and international studies. Many of you will be familiar with her work to date. I've had the pleasure and the frustration of reading this book over the last fortnight. I say frustration because as a young academic, the book makes a mockery of every excuse we tell ourselves as academics to justify the gulf between our work as it is and our work as we would like it to be. Louise in this book has managed to bring together theory, and by that I mean feminist theory, social theory, legal theory, political theory, with a rich and incredibly intricate empirical analysis, and at the same time manages to be politically astute and provide constructive solutions. This is a fine work, and I commend it to you all and can't wait to hear Louise speak about it. To sort of say a little bit, though, about the centre, it also folds in beautifully with the aims of the Centre for Women, Peace and Security, which aims the centre to provide an academic space in which to develop strategies to promote gender equality, justice and participation of women in conflict-affected situations. We may have to adopt this book as something of a guide, a manifesto, a mission statement, certainly in the area of international criminal justice. A brief word about the format for this evening. We'll start with a presentation from Louise, and then we're going to move into my indulgence in having a conversation briefly with Louise to tease out some of that incredible empirical work to reflect on some of the contemporary challenges and practical challenges that the ICC faces. But I want to leave as much time as possible for questions from the floor. So either wave your hands at me while we're having our conversation if you want to feed into that, or else I'll be leaving plenty of time for questions from the floor. With that, I'd like to welcome Louise.
Thank you. Thanks, Devika, so much for such a generous welcome. And I'd like to start just by saying how delighted I am to be here tonight at this new Centre for Women, Peace and Security at LSE. And I think it's already becoming the emerging preeminent centre for the study around women, peace and security internationally. I'm very grateful to Professor Christine Chinkin, the Director of the Centre, for hosting the event tonight, and it's a great honour for me to be presenting my work here in her presence, who, along with fellow LSE Professor Anne Phillips from the Gender Institute, are two of the most eminent scholars in the field of gender justice, on whose shoulders I've been standing in writing this book. And it's also a delight for me that Devika is chairing this session tonight. It's not only a pleasure because we share many connections at the University of New South Wales and hadn't actually had the chance to meet before yesterday, but Devika's own important work on international criminal law has helped me understand the way that influences what happens in the domestic sphere. Before I begin, can I thank the amazing Zoe Gillard for all she's done in making this event happen tonight, and thank my support crew over here, my husband Robert and dear friends Pauline and John for being here. So I thought I'd start tonight by setting the scene with an explanation of the cover of the book, of the image on the cover. This is Rubens, The Consequences of War. It was painted in 1638 and captures the turmoil of the 30 Years' War that was engulfing Europe at the time. Importantly, the war ended in 1648 with the Peace of Westphalia, which is a series of treaties that established the foundations of the contemporary international relations system, based, of course, on the principles of state sovereignty. The allegorical painting commissioned by the Medici family projects very much a strong anti-war message, reflecting the devastating consequences of conflict. In this masterpiece, the central illuminated figure is Venus, the Roman goddess of love, who appears as a plaintive victim. Despite her entreaties, her lover Mars, the god of war, seems determined to continue the battle, spurred on by the wicked Alecto, the goddess of fury. The darkly draped figure of Europa looks on desperately while her sister, representing arts and culture, is trampled. The cowering woman clinging to her child points to the particular vulnerability of mothers and children in warfare. The nakedness of almost all the female figures is a reminder to us of the violations of women's bodies in war. In illustrating the terror and destruction that comes with conflict, the painting reminds us that war has always been understood in gendered terms, represented primarily by the male warrior and the female victim. Though here, with the presence of Alecto, Rubens also raises the spectre of another female archetype, the furious monster. These gendered dimensions of conflict, conveyed with such powerful imagery in Rubens' painting, have not only been reflected in art, but also in conflict-related politics and in diplomacy and in the laws of war. And as Professor Chinkin, Hilary Charlesworth and other prominent feminist legal scholars have detailed, international humanitarian and criminal law, including under the Geneva Conventions, has tended to portray men as the architects and the combatants of battle, the active legal subjects of armed conflict. But by contrast, women have been treated primarily as vulnerable victims, as mothers, but rarely as independent public actors. In distinction to Rubens' masterpiece, women's roles as belligerents and perpetrators of violence has largely been ignored, as have men's roles as victims of sexual and gender-based violence. The foundations of contemporary international law developed at the time of Rubens' painting were strongly influenced, as many of you know, by the Dutch diplomat Hugo Grotius. According to international legal scholar Diane Amann, Grotius's worldview, quote, depicts women and children as bystanders, beings not fully conscious of the world around them, not actors but rather objects in the tableau of the battlefield. Importantly for my work, the law has been especially blind to the systematic and widespread use of sexual and gender-based violence experienced by men and boys, but especially by women and girls. For millennia, conflict-related sexual violence has largely been seen as an unfortunate but incidental consequence of war. Where such violence has been recognised as a crime, it's been considered in Grotius's term as a, quote, violation of chastity. Rape and other forms of sexual violence have been considered a crime against the honour of a woman and her male protector, but not a grievous violation equivalent to other atrocity crimes. Rarely identified, investigated or prosecuted, the victims of conflict-related sexual violence have survived without the protection of the law, left to carry the shame and stigma of their traumatic experiences on their own. In these extraordinary instances where the perpetrators of these crimes have been put on trial, their victims have often suffered a re-traumatisation in the courtroom. These victims have faced humiliating questioning, aspersions about their character, a disbelief in their testimony. Prosecutors, relying on methods that are often inappropriate for the investigation of sexual violence crimes, have assumed that these crimes are necessarily harder to investigate and prove in a court of law, a view judges have helped to encourage and reinforce. These are what I call the gendered legacies of international criminal justice. And in my new book, I'm interested in exploring how far international law has moved from the gendered images depicted in Rubens' painting and historically codified in international criminal law. To what extent do the gender justice rules underpinning the new International Criminal Court reflect a turning point in the recognition of women as victims of sexual and gender-based violence? Where and why have some of these new provisions been resisted? And what are the consequences of the gender justice outcomes of the ICC for the legitimacy of the court? In investigating these questions, I'm not focused on a normative argument about what or whether international criminal law should be a venue for gender justice activism, although I do recognise this is a very live and contentious debate within the literature. Rather, I'm keen to explore the extent to which the promise of the Rome Statute has been delivered in practice and what effect this has on the views of the gender justice community in and around the ICC. So before I explore the gender justice mandate of the court and its implementation, I think it's just worth taking a very quick step back to consider the ICC's innovative framework. The negotiations over the rules of the court occurred throughout the mid-1990s, culminating in the Rome Statute in 1998. These negotiations were a drawn-out political process in which the Women's Caucus for Gender Justice and a very lively civil society community played a restricted but nonetheless very significant role. As many of you will know, the ICC is a unique institution in a number of respects. It's the first permanent court with the capacity to prosecute individuals at all levels, including heads of state. It has jurisdiction over the worst atrocities, crimes against humanity, war crimes, genocide, and in future the crime of aggression, taking these crimes much further than the ad hoc tribunals for the former Yugoslavia and Rwanda. It is based on the notion of complementarity, which recognises the ICC is an apex court, a court of last resort. States will only become subject to ICC jurisdiction if they demonstrate an inability or unwillingness to investigate these atrocities at home. It's a hybrid institution, bringing together in a somewhat uneasy relationship both retributive and victims' redress elements. Its retributive face seeks to prosecute individuals for committing crimes under the statute, while its redress element gives victims rights at all stages of the proceedings, and for the first time under international criminal law, under an international criminal law tribunal, provides a reparations framework. The Rome Statute establishes a trust fund for victims, which has a dual mandate, both to provide assistance to victims in situation countries and also to administer and, to some extent, design the reparations stemming from convictions of individuals at the court. After a great deal of negotiation, it was decided that referrals would come from the prosecutor using his or her own powers, the UN Security Council, and states' parties. And it's transpired in the first few years of practice that the states' parties can also refer themselves to the court. So there are currently 123 states' parties to the court, importantly not some of the key international players, not the US, not China, not Israel, not India. It has currently 23 cases before it, and all of them currently stemming from African conflicts. Some of these have been self-referrals, some from the Security Council, and one from the first prosecutor using his powers. The ICC is at the same time undertaking investigations as to admissibility in a range of other regions, including countries such as Afghanistan, Iraq, Georgia, Colombia, and is investigating whether it has jurisdiction in a case related to the Israel-Palestinian conflict. In its first decade, the court can't really boast a very strong record in terms of its convictions. It's handed down two guilty verdicts, one acquittal, each relating to the Democratic of the Congo conflict. So in terms of understanding the gender justice mandate of the court, it's important to understand the role that the Women's Caucus played here. The caucus went to the Rome negotiation process with a series of very clearly defined objectives. They wanted the incorporation of the full range of core crimes against women included in the statute and a recognition of their gravity. They wanted the removal of gender discrimination in the application of the law, adequate personnel and resources for the effective prosecution of gender crimes, and a court with a victim's redress mandate, including provision for reparations. And as is always the case in these negotiations, the politics surrounding gender justice claims were highly contentious. Some states, backed by the Holy See and other conservative religious supporters, strongly resisted many of the objectives of the Women's Caucus. As a result, the final document to emerge reflected, as all international documents do, a compromise between these forces, with some of the key gender objectives included, others watered down, and others left out altogether. Summing up this negotiation process, one of the core caucus members, Barbara Bedont, captured these mixed outcomes. She says, "At 2 o'clock in the morning on July the 18th, 1998, in a bar by the Colosseum, a group of delegates celebrated the adoption of the statute. I sat amongst them, not knowing how to react to their jubilation. While I was relieved that the statute had been adopted, I couldn't help but mourn the loss of many provisions which would have made the court stronger. Finally, when some of the delegates started to sing, 'We are the champions,' I knew the time for me to go had come." Despite these reservations, many gender justice actors expressed a willingness to work with the court to try and realise the framework, which came to include elements of what social theorist Nancy Fraser identifies as the three core dimensions of gender justice, related to gender recognition, representation and redistribution. And in the statute we see these playing out in the following ways. The recognition includes the widest ever range of conflict-related sexual and gender-based crimes under international law and an acknowledgement of the gravity of these crimes. The recognition of gender as a ground for persecution, also for the first time under international law. The caucus convinced states to include provisions for fair representation of women judges, as well as gender experts across all aspects of the court's work. And they're also a key influence on the redress element, including the provision for reparations. So the question then is, how well have these provisions been implemented in the court's first decade and a half? And I now want to tell a story around each of these three areas, starting with the question around recognition. So first, on the very positive side of the ledger, there's been a growing recognition of gender justice in the work of the court, which has been evident in the way in which sexual violence crimes against women and girls are increasingly being investigated and included in charges by the Office of the Prosecutor. As of February this year, 80% of cases included charges for such crimes. There's also been some evidence in the prosecutor's charging strategy of a growing understanding of how sexual violence is experienced by victims. This means sexual and gender-based violence charges have not only been charged as rape, but also as torture, sexual slavery, and as humiliation and degrading treatment. The court has learnt important lessons from the Yugoslav and Rwandan tribunals and has established extensive procedural rules that recognise the specific harm suffered by victims of sexual and gender-based violence. This has included improved courtroom procedures, the appointment of skilled legal representatives, and the provision of psychosocial support for victims during their courtroom appearances. However, on the negative side of the recognition ledger, we see that the most challenging area of the ICC's gender justice practice has been ensuring that these sexual and gender-based charges are properly investigated, charged, and importantly, successfully prosecuted. My PhD student, Rose Gray, has just completed a very important study on prosecutorial discretion at the ICC, in which she shows that although the prosecutor is increasingly charging sexual and gender-based violations, there's a significant fall-off of these charges during the course of proceedings. Now, of course, if anyone here engaged in criminal law knows, this decline in charges should be expected in any criminal trial, as the standard of proof increases with each stage. However, as Rose's data in this table shows, with the sexual crimes marked in pink, the drop-off is much steeper for these sexual and gender-based crimes than others. And we're left with a very stark outcome that in its first 14 years in practice, the ICC has failed to secure a single conviction for sexual or gender-based violence. As one scholar has recently noted, there must be more going on here than just a question of technicalities of the law. Another recognition problem at the court is that the Office of the Prosecutor has appeared to pay very little attention in its complementarity investigations to establish what action, if any, states are undertaking to address reported crimes of sexual and gender-based violence through domestic proceedings. Gender justice actors concerned during the court's design phase are seen to be being borne out in practice here. That is, the lack of overt provisions in the Rome Statute to allow the court to scrutinise domestic sexual violence prosecutions helps to maintain impunity for these crimes at both the national and international levels. Because of all of these problems, I argue, the recognition dimension of the gender justice framework has been the least well implemented in the court's early years. I think two factors help explain this outcome, both of which I argue are tied to the gendered legacies of the law. First is the ongoing weakness in investigations and evidence gathering undertaken by the Office of the Prosecutor. ICC judges and gender justice actors have been scathing in their criticism of the Office of the Prosecutor, especially during the time of the first prosecutor, Marina Ocampo, for evidence being insufficient, poorly pleaded, and incapable of supporting the charges sought. But I don't think all the blame for the ICC's lack of a conviction in its first 14 years can rest at the door of the prosecutor. Judges too have contributed to this poor outcome. In a number of cases where the prosecution has advanced very strong evidence, judges have adopted a very narrow reading of the law, sometimes much narrower than the ICTY or ICTR, including their rejection of the more expansive notions of humiliation based on gender, the recognition of rape as a form of torture, as just two cases in point. In one of the most bizarre rulings of all, in a Kenyan case, judges refused to accept that forced circumcision and penile amputations were sexual crimes, reflecting a very limited understanding of the gendered nature and varied experiences of sexual violence. So now let's turn to the story of representation. And I'd argue this is one of the most unambiguous standout and initial developments of the court in terms of a positive outcome. For most of the ICC's first decade, women judges have been represented in equal, if not greater, numbers than men. And as the pink line in this graph shows, this figure has increased at almost every election since the first in 2002 until the 2014 election. Women's judicial representation at the ICC surpasses any record of a domestic court that I can find, as well as far outstripping any international criminal tribunal. In the book, I echo the arguments of Anne Phillips in her important work on the politics of presence to argue that this representation of women is important in its own right, no matter what their political, and by this I mean their gender justice orientations. Having women on the bench sends a critical message to the world that they are equal international citizens and have both the right and the capacity to adjudicate on matters of global significance. But importantly, as the literature on gender and legislatures by my colleagues such as Sarah Childs here tonight tells us, in terms of gender justice outcomes, it's not just the number of women that matter, but whether both women and men within international settings are committed to gender equality goals. It's important in this context to note that the ICC does include rules to have judges with sexual and gender-based violence expertise. And based on their available biographies, it does transpire that the majority of judges on the court do claim to have this expertise, developed in their years as lawyers, judges, or as academics. Given the predominance of judges with these backgrounds, we can hope that there's a greater likelihood, but of course no guarantee, that the statute sexual and gender-based crimes will be interpreted in ways to potentially advance gender justice. But as I've already mentioned, evidence does suggest that many of these judges have indeed failed to bring this background to bear on their initial judgments. But there have been some important exceptions. And here the image, larger image of Costa Rican judge Elizabeth Odio Benito, who in the first ICC's case on the DRC in relation to Thomas Lubanga, is a case in point. In this case, she made a dissenting judgment that took a strong gender justice position, arguing that girl soldiers faced a very different form of persecution than boy soldiers because of their gender. And while her minority dissent did not influence the ultimate outcome of that case, we can see that it has since had an impact on the jurisprudence at the court and has been picked up in other cases going forward now in relation to understanding this gender difference in child soldier cases. Significant too in terms of representation is the election in 2012 of the second prosecutor, Fatou Bensouda. And as you might be able to see in this slide here, she's pledged to make gender crimes a priority of her 9-year term. In her most recent statement, made only yesterday, marking the International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women, Prosecutor Bensouda stated in relation to sexual and gender-based violence crimes, quote, "In accordance with my mandate, I'll spare no effort in bringing accountability for such heinous crimes. Where others may want to draw a veil over these crimes, I, as prosecutor, must draw a line under them." As a sign of the prosecutor's commitment to this area, in 2012, she appointed Bridget Inder from Women's Initiatives for Gender Justice as her gender advisor. And together they've designed the prosecution's first comprehensive gender policy, which was released in July last year. And we are disappointed tonight that Bridget couldn't join us. She was going to be part of this conversation, but due to ill health, she couldn't be here, unfortunately. So we also see some problems, of course, in this area of representation, and I think it's becoming much more apparent in the period since actually I finished writing the book in the last 6 to 8 months. There's some troubling signs around representation after such a strong start. In the past 2 years, there's been a dramatic reduction in the number of female candidates being put forward by states to the Assembly of States parties for election to the bench, and as a consequence, a reduction in the number of female judges being elected to the chambers. The 2014 judicial election saw a dramatic turnaround, with 6 men winning the 6 judicial vacancies, halving the representation of women on the ICC bench from 60 to 30%. One of the reasons for this shift, which we can discuss more in discussion, is the effort states are putting in to circumventing the formal rules included in the Rome Statute around voting for judges. This includes the obvious re-emergence of backroom diplomatic deal-making, which is always operated to preclude women's access to representation in international bodies. And I'm very pleased to see a new campaign around this, around the QQOL initiative to push women's appointments on international tribunals. So let's turn now to the third and final gender justice dimension in relation to redistribution. This is one of the most unique features of the Rome Statute. The Court's Trust Fund for Victims has responsibility for administering any reparations orders of the court, as well as its own assistance programs in situation countries. The Trust Fund has demonstrated a clear determination in developing its programs to address the needs of women and girls, including the education of former girl soldiers, support for women and girls who have borne children of conflict-related rape, and special women's healthcare facilities. But the ICC also confronts gender justice discrepancies across this victims' redress system. Importantly, many fewer women are involved in the ICC's outreach program or come forward to register as victims. In the Darfur case, for instance, 70% fewer women are registered as victims. This gender disparity, I argue, has a knock-on effect. It leads to problems of recognition without women's voices in the courtroom as victims. International criminal law remains left with only a very partial understanding of women's experiences of war and conflict. But it also potentially sets up problems for the court's redistributive functions. It could be the case that if you're not registered as a victim, you won't be able to claim reparations at the end of a case. So not coming forward in those early stages of the trial can lead to major discrimination at the end of it. So in the first decade and a half of ICC practice, it's clear that some of the court's new rules are being used some of the time to advance gender justice claims. But we've also seen some very concerning trends, including signs of resistance to applying the progressive gender justice rules in the statute. Signs of this resistance has been relatively subtle, and there's no evidence, I don't think, to suggest that ICC personnel are overtly rejecting the formal gender rules. But I don't agree that it's a problem of unconscious bias either. After 3 decades of high-profile gender justice advocacy and the codification of a detailed gender mandate in the Rome Statute, it's hard to believe that anyone operating in the world of international criminal law could remain unconscious of the significance and the need for remedy of these gender justice concerns. What we are seeing at the court, I think, is a process of displacement, what my Edinburgh colleague Fiona Mackay would call a case of remembering the old and forgetting the new. In the first decade, we've seen examples of the Office of the Prosecutor, judges and other actors at the court allowing the legacies of the law to slip back in, to infiltrate, if you like, its operations with very few pockets of resistance. This highlights the tenacity of gender legacies of the law. And one reason, I think, for their persistence is that they're very hard to identify and to tackle. I suggest that they are instantiated not primarily through positive action, but through episodes of inaction. For example, where ICC personnel have not pursued investigations of particular charges, where they have not gathered essential evidence, and where they have not remembered earlier legal judgments, which advanced a more sophisticated understanding of the law. As Hilary Charlesworth pointed out many years ago, it's the silence of the law that can be the most powerful, the most difficult to identify and to address. Because of the permeation of gender legacies of the law into ICC practice, we are witnessing what I think is a gender justice legitimacy gap. A gap that spans a growing distance between the ICC's aspirational commitments and its inconsistent practice. This is a very worrying development, not least because it could lead to the disengagement and eventual withdrawal of support by gender justice actors. Given the place of these actors as one of the ICC's core constituencies, this would be a significant blow to an already fragile institution. But it's important to remember that for legitimacy to be maintained, it's not necessary that all constituents' demands are met all the time. International relations theorists Robert Cohen and Alan Buchanan remind us, institutions can still, quote, be worthy of our support, even if they do not maximally serve our interests. Rather, as they suggest, legitimacy depends on institutional actors being committed to maintaining accountability and transparency in relation to its interested publics, and willing to undertake ongoing critical review and revision of their goals and actions. What I'm saying here is that for the ICC to maintain support of its gender justice constituency, it doesn't always need to focus on the demands of this community or indeed to perfectly implement the court's gender justice mandate. Rather, the ICC must work to engage this constituency, but will it be willing to justify its decisions and policies to it and display an ongoing commitment to learning from and acting on its obvious failures and shortcomings? Encouragingly, it does appear that the court is putting some effort into maintaining the confidence of this gender justice constituency, despite its dismal prosecution record and other initial missteps. The prosecutor's 2014 gender policy, I've already mentioned, is probably the best example of this. The policy demonstrates a willingness of Prosecutor Ben Souda to critically reflect on court practices in its first decade, to identify significant shortcomings and commit to revising strategic and operational policy. The ICC has already recently undertaken other reviews, including in relation to victims' standing at the court, and it's starting to adjust its practices in this area. The recent Trust Fund report on the application of reparations in the Lubanga case also reflects a strong gender justice framework, thanks in part to committed gender justice insiders such as the Trust Fund's Kristen Keller and the advice of Fionnuala Niaolan and others from Ulster's Transitional Justice Institute, who worked with the fund to frame this policy. As we know, the proof of these measures is in their implementation. Nevertheless, I do think that even without their adoption yet in practice, these reform efforts send an important signal that the ICC is taking seriously this legitimacy gap and seeking to respond appropriately. I also want to suggest that strengthening the ICC requires a two-way effort, not only from the court to its constituency, but vice versa. I think it's important for the long-term viability of the ICC that the external gender justice community and the broader civil society movement responds in two ways. First, I think it's important that they reassess and perhaps dampen their expectations about what the court can deliver, as I think over the years there's been a degree of mission creep and unrealistic and expanded expectations about the court's role, both by the gender justice community and others in the civil society community. Like all international organisations, the ICC's aspirations are not matched by its capacity, and the debates just last week around the court's budget is a very stark reminder of that. This is not to let the ICC off the hook for not implementing its gender justice mandate, but to ask the constituency surrounding the court to follow the court's lead, to take stock, to re-evaluate the court's capabilities, and to realign its objectives within these limitations. Second, I want to suggest that the ICC's gender justice constituency and the broader women's rights movement become more focused on how to catalyse the court's mandate, especially its complementarity provisions, to strengthen gender justice at the national level. This is where the action is, in my view. This could include gender justice groups operating within national settings and through national human rights regimes to support investigation and evidence-gathering processes. And most productively, these organisations could encourage states to ratify the statute and then, importantly, implement its advanced gender justice rules into the local penal code so that it's strong enough to actually undertake these prosecutions at the domestic level. Bringing domestic law up to a standard equivalent to the Rome Statute is certain to be a more fruitful avenue for addressing impunity for conflict-related sexual violence crimes than a handful of high-profile prosecutions in The Hague. So to summarise, I think the gender justice framework at the ICC has been shaped by the formal rules of the Rome Statute and simultaneously reinforced and undermined by the ongoing influence of informal legacies of international criminal law. The test into the future will be for the court to maintain its relationship with its diverse and core constituencies, to learn from its practices and be willing to be able to revise its operations to better reflect its mandate to ensure that the perpetrators of crimes against humanity, war crimes and genocide are held accountable and victims of these atrocities gain access to justice. Thank you.
Thank you, Louise. That's fantastic, and it leaves us a good amount of time. Sorry, there's a little friend I have to bring with us. Oh, okay. Almost three quarters of an hour for discussion. So as I say, I'm just going to start with a few little questions, and obviously you've raised a great deal and our audience is bubbling not just with expertise but with questions. Now, as Louise mentioned, we're very sad that Bridget Inder can't join us tonight. Special Gender Advisor to Fatou Ben Souda and also Executive Director of the Women's Initiatives for Gender Justice. I don't want to get into Bridget Inder's private health issues. But it does raise for me the notion of exhaustion, and that in terms of gender justice, and Louise goes into some detail about the PrepCom and the Rome Conference and the efforts on the part of the Women's Caucus at driving for what were in the end a success story. Of course, there were some failings and that sad anecdote, where someone felt so despondent as to leave a celebration. But there was a lot to celebrate that was achieved. But nevertheless, this word exhaustion does crop up from time to time in the book, a sense that there's so much to do but so few resources. Could we start most recently? So Louise has just come back from the Assembly of States Parties, the annual meeting of the Assembly of States Parties. Could you talk to us a little bit about the mood and the extent to which gender justice is part of the conversation among the States Parties, or the extent to which it's not, and how this might be detrimental?
I think the whole story of the court is a mixed one. You have simultaneously really positive and really negative things going on at the same time all the time. And that happened at last week's meeting. So for the very first time, they gave aside a whole session in the general debate to the question on gender and complementarity. And this was the first time ever that those two concepts were put together and discussed. The room was packed. It had very, very good representation from the 123 states parties who all wanted to intervene. Like, everyone was pushing their microphones, all wanting to say something in that session, which was fantastic, I think, because that discussion is about states taking more responsibility, and they wanted to engage in that discussion. But at the same time, there's a real mood around the court about a frustration about this lack of successful prosecution, the delays at the court, the ongoing problems of trying to get women access to the victims' outreach services so that they can actually have a voice through the court. And this gets wrapped up in a very practical issue around the budget. So while we have these grand statements and aspirational statements being made all the time at the court about how important it is and how much it's doing, it's also the states' parties wanting to slash its budget. So this year they want to make a 2% cut to the budget. At the same time, they're calling on the court to open new cases. And I was able to have a conversation with the prosecutor earlier this week, and she said, "My job is absolutely impossible. I want to open new cases, including in Georgia, which is extremely important because the court has to have cases wider than Africa. So politically, it's extremely important." But she said, "I can't even afford to run the cases that I've got open already, let alone do these other cases." And what she's trying to do in those cases is put this gender perspective through all of them. So exhaustion is an issue. I mean, she was exhausted because the other thing she was doing was meeting on the sidelines all week with the African delegations led by Kenya and South Africa, who were talking about wanting to pull out of the court. She's dealing with France, who's leading the push to cut the budget. And she's trying to pursue a gender justice framework and push up against these gender legacies of the law. So she is surrounded by important people like Bridget Inda as her gender advisor and other members of the Coalition for the ICC. But it's just a constant battle. And the minute you take your eye off one area of this gender justice framework, the gains are lost. And I think that's what's happened with the gender judging issue. We've seen this massive drop-off of the number of female candidates being put forward because advocacy around that part of the court has dropped off because the gender justice advocates are thinking, well, that work's done, we'll go and concentrate over here. And the minute they've done that, states have pulled away and gone back to doing these old backroom deals, which are terribly frustrating and terribly damaging for women's representation.
Yeah, and so it brings up, you know, prosecutor, judges, where, you know, don't take your eye off the ball. But actually, it seems we have a prosecutor who's working very hard on the gender justice front. Can we take our eye off that ball? Yes. Has she implemented in that policy paper something, therefore, that will not go away, building in that culture that's very hard to put the genie back in the bottle once it's sort of become part of the prosecutorial culture. Anyway, but getting into the judges versus prosecutor, can we look at this through the lens of Lubanga, for example? Because I think that shows a prosecutor, Moreno Ocampo, contrasted then with Bensouda's approach. So what I'm asking is, can you tell us a bit of more of the story of Lubanga? Odio Benito, the reaction to her judgment, because you talk about constituency a lot in the book, which is obviously so, so vital. What was the reaction of the various constituencies to Odio Benito's judgment? And you also raise the idea that in future cases that, that even though it had no impact potentially in Lubanga, that it might have impacted on future cases. Can you tell us the story of Lubanga?
So I imagine a number of you know this, this tragic story from a gender justice perspective. Lubanga, a warlord from the DRC, in a situation where sexual violence crimes were absolutely rampant. And both the UN Secretary General at the time, Kofi Annan, recognised this. The Office of the Prosecutor recognised this initially and went out doing investigations and evidence gathering around these crimes. But shortly after the case sort of got underway, the prosecutor's office said, we're going to put those crimes to one side because we want a speedy prosecution to show that the ICC's here. We're not going to worry about sexual and gender-based crimes. We're going to just go on child soldier charges. And in doing that, did not even consider that in those child soldier charges that there's a sexual violence and gender basis to those. So the women's initiatives at that time went on the ground themselves and gathered a mountain of evidence from 60 witnesses and took it back to the Office of the Prosecutor before the case opened and said, would you reopen the charges and add these charges in? And he said, possibly later at another stage, but I'm not going to do it now. So the trial started without any of those charges included. And then a very strange thing started to happen, was that the prosecution started to try and argue that even though they hadn't added sexual and gender-based crimes, that there were elements of gender playing out in the child soldier charges. And this was coming through the testimony because everyone who was talking about it was saying the girls and boys were treated completely differently and that you've got to see the gendered components of it. But the arguments that the prosecution was making was incredibly convoluted and bizarre in some cases and very strange. And the judges kept saying, well, do you want to bring charges of sexual and gender-based violence? And all the way through, the prosecutor just kept saying, no, 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 no. So when it came to the verdict and sentencing stage, the judges, the majority of two judges said, we are not able to recognise sexual and gender-based crimes because he has not been charged with those crimes. Odio Benito, a feminist judge, said, well, I disagree. There are gendered elements to those crimes that I'm going to say that there is gender discrimination being undertaken in relation to those crimes, and I want to recognise that in my dissent in judgment. And the backlash to her judgment was very strong by some other constituents, some prominent male international criminal lawyers in particular, saying she's not acting impartially by making this claim, she's operating outside the law. Well, if you read Article 21 of the statute, she wasn't. She was applying the gender discrimination provisions that were there, was not stretching the law by any means. She was using what is potentially a transformative tool in the statute. But it was a good case, I think, to show the resistance there still is, even to use the law that exists, that there's still a sense that this is some radical interpretation of the law. And she was, I mean, she's very feisty. She just said, well, I'll show you which part of the statute I'm using and I'll defend my argument. So Lubanga itself looked like a completely lost case as it relates to gender and sexual domestic-based violence crimes, including the fact that now with the appeals chamber judgment around reparations, the court has continued to say the prosecution did not charge sexual and gender-based crimes, so we can't even recognise this in the reparations. So this is a real problem in going forward with those reparations decisions. But her judgment has now really influenced the next staging of charges in future cases, where the difference between girls and boy child soldiers is being recognised, both by the prosecution and in the preliminary judgments coming out of the chambers. So you think everything's lost, but in fact her influence is infiltrating to some extent. But again, it's going to require ongoing pressure to ensure that that's carried forward in the longer term.
And we see that certainly in the Ugandan Ongwen case, where a blog today that Louise had mentioned referred to the fact that this is the greatest number of charges that we've had. Now, what I worry about, though, is this backlash. Moreno Ocampo, a lot to be said about him. Although one thing that I think he was trying to do was ensure speedier trials. So this was on the back of the Yugoslav tribunal, where it was felt that they'd made too many charges, cases were too long and unwieldy, and so he was trying to sort of make these sort of surgical strike cases where let's pick the easiest thing to prove, which of course is not sexual violence crimes, and this is problematic. The problem with Fatou Bensouda now coming and making these bigger charge sheets is potentially then the backlash if we get longer trials, greater delay. Mm. But in Ongwen, I mean, do you Tuganda as well? Are these cases? What other examples?
I think it's really interesting that they've gone back and revised. So some of these initial arrest warrants were laid back in 2005 under Ocampo, and that they're going back and reopening these as these people are being brought before the court and they're reinvestigating. And Bensouda said she's going to keep undertaking the investigations and making sure she gets the evidence for this. But she is now really looking expansively across the statute. She's adding things for the first time, like forced marriage and so on, in these latest charges in the Ongwen Ugandan case. So potentially it's going to advance the law by, you know, testing these cases out. I was listening in a session the other day at the ASP, a number of the other prosecutors from the OTP saying, but we are going to follow the evidence, because there's no point in us putting up charges we don't have evidence for. If we've learned anything in our first decade, is that it's devastating for victims to be told that someone's going to be prosecuted for these crimes and it to come to nothing, which all of those charges have so far come to nothing. So I think they're much more careful about including charges only once they've got the evidence. And they said there and then they're not going to just add sexual violence and gender crimes into everything. They're only going to do it when they think they've got a reasonable case. So Ongwen has got 67 charges now in that case. Mm. If the prosecution right in what it's saying, then it's got evidence for that. Mm. But we'll see.
You also have a fantastic response to this, which is your question of complementarity, the issue of complementarity, and you said expressly, this is where the action is. It's more, even those charges, sheeting back the responsibility to the domestic sphere. And I'm sorry, of course, you know, I'm assuming we all know what complementarity is. Of course, it gives primacy to domestic courts for prosecution, the International Criminal Court, a court of last resort. So complementarity, this is where the action is. You've got an incredibly rich study of the domestic laws of states, how many actually have the crimes in the court before them. And it's remarkable how few. And rape, I mean, so you studied 50 states. Rape is the highest, has the highest number, but that's only 34 states, even there. Mm. Complementarity, you know, obviously it's seen the caucus, Women's Caucus felt they'd failed to inject it into the statute, but we're now looking at the interpretation, because actually the wording of the statute is quite vague and is ambiguous in this, to the extent that the prosecutor in her policy has managed to inject a way of interpreting unwilling or unable. So I know many of you are aware of this, but the International Criminal Court can only take jurisdiction where domestic jurisdictions are unwilling or unable. So the question is whether unwillingness can be interpreted from, for example, not having the crime on the books.
Yeah,
can you just explain that a little more? And then I really do want to open it to
the floor. I think this is where the Women's Caucus really did think they failed in Rome, was that they didn't get to encourage states to agree that the court could look over their penal codes, and if they didn't have reasonable crimes around sexual and gender-based violence, it would be seen to be claims for inability. And therefore admissibility to the ICC. And I think what Bensouda is saying in her gender policy is she's going to take that very seriously, and she's going to really start checking whether or not courts are taking seriously these conflict-related sexual and gender-based violence crimes, and if not, potentially see it as a reason for admitting the case to the court. If that happened, I mean, that's a very radical move, and it will be really interesting to see if she does play that out. I think the complementarity regime operates as a stick in that sense, in that the prosecutor can drag a court before drag a state before the ICC, but it prefers to think of this notion of positive complementarity, in that it wants to encourage states to be doing it themselves. And basically, as the first prosecutor said, we don't actually want to exist. What we would like is every state to be doing it for themselves, using a very high standard of prosecution across all these crimes. So get your own houses in order and do it yourself, and then we don't have to worry about it. So the prosecution and the court as a whole really does take this idea that its role is not there as a development organisation to go in and train prosecutors or judges or whatever, but to really try and just provide the environment to support them to go about doing that domestic-based prosecution. And I really noticed this change in discourse at the ICC in this last meeting, that they're very keen to push it back to the domestic level, if for budgetary reasons, if no other, because they can't afford to be doing it in The Hague. And we talk about these surgical strikes. Well, Ocampo's first case, if you count the reparations process, is still going on 10 years later. So it's hardly, a good scenario for anyone, but especially the victims who are caught up in these cases, who 10 years on have still not seen justice in any real sense, I think, on the ground.
Okay, folks, over to you.
Do we have any questions or comments? Yes, of course we do. Yes, could you say your name potentially?
Oh, sure. Yeah. My name's Claire. Hi.
Hi, Claire.
You mentioned that in one case there were 60 witnesses as evidence for sexual violence crimes, and bringing that against the person in question. What counts as evidence? You keep saying that the prosecutors are saying there's not enough evidence. The judges appear to be saying, please bring this forward as a charge, kind of encourage them. So what is preventing the prosecutors, what would count as evidence?
So there's many layers to that. So the criticism has been that they've been using a lot of unreliable evidence and not necessarily witness or victim-based evidence. And the prosecution says, well, this is really problematic to get that sort of evidence. In these communities where there's so much stigma is attached to these crimes, where you're probably living in communities where the soldier who attacked you may well still be there, but you're trying to get the person who ordered that soldier to commit that crime, it is very difficult. And making that link between the act itself and the commander has been a huge challenge for the court. But I think one of the developments in that gender policy is that the prosecutor has said, what we need to do is enhance the capacity of all sorts of people on the ground to gather evidence. So health professionals who are there on the ground identifying rape victims, just doing simple things like you know, taking not necessarily statements but recording patterns, so that there is some basis to the evidence where you're not needing to call forward individuals who have gone through these sorts of problems. And until now, a lot of that hasn't been done. So when the prosecution's been trying to make a case, it's been sometimes has been on fairly flimsy evidence, and there has been good grounds why some judges have dismissed the cases. They just say, we can't, this does not prove the case. So that's been important. And one of the reasons that these cases are taking so long is that defence rights are taken incredibly seriously at the ICC. It's a new institution, and every single point of law is argued in every single case. So that's a good thing, you know, in terms of upholding those standards of the law. But I think what Bensouda is saying is we've got to think about prosecuting these particular crimes in a new way. It's not to say we don't need strong evidence, but your question, what is going to count as evidence? And how can we get around the fact that we're not necessarily going to get access to witnesses and victims in the same way? Because those who aren't the victims but have witnessed it often don't want to tell the story, and those who have experienced themselves definitely don't want to tell the story. And I shouldn't say that always, because some of those victims are desperate to tell their stories and they will do everything they can to have their day in court. And at least what this court does is provide those sorts of protections for those people, so they don't, you know, it's in-camera hearings, they don't have to confront their alleged perpetrators, you know, face-to-face and all those sorts of things.
For your patience, keeping your hand up. Yep.
Thank you very much for your talk. I don't really understand what you're doing. I mean, the ICC is clearly a completely useless organisation.
Yes, well, lots
you
of people
didn't open up that at the beginning of your talk, and yet you're still working with a completely useless organisation that has no interest whatsoever in equality. I find that very bizarre. You did touch upon something that I felt was relevant, though, and that was the actual religious element to this. And I think that the only way forward is not through the law or ICC, because that is clearly useless, but to start going for the religious institutions which dominate the legal system of this world, England, Europe, and all the other places, attack that and put yourself above their law, then you will be able to find justice, not only just for women and terrible rape crimes, but for everyone, and equality would be a dominant factor in that. So I think that if you really want to make this work, then a written constitution has to be done by yourself, which each country has to apply to, otherwise there is no success whatsoever, just more disappointment. Thank you very much, Richard.
I'm a pragmatist and an incrementalist, basically.
Same here.
I don't think you are, in the same way.
Constitution is not that much to ask for, especially one that would give rights to every single human being.
Well,
we don't have rights.
I mean, I think the question is, we operate in an international relations system where it's completely imperfect. And trying to find compromises and ways through that is always the challenge. So do we make, do we go after something that's relatively good while we're looking for the perfect solution? I don't know. The court is extremely problematic. But in my view, I'd rather have it than not. But I understand that these religious forces play an incredibly important role. So during the negotiations around the Rome Statute, was this happening at the same time around some of the negotiations around the first Iraq War? So certain countries were going to war with each other over these questions of Iraq. At the same time, they were joining together in other parts of the UN building at the same time to work together to block advancements in relation to these gender elements of the ICC statute. It's a crazy world. It's a really crazy world, and getting crazier, I think, which is why I think the rule of law is really important.
Hands are sprouting. I'm sorry, there's so many questions. Do you mind if I start grouping perhaps if we take...
Yeah.
Let's start with two questions at once. So, sorry, these two... could I start with you, please?
Yes, my name is Dina. I'm a student at UCL. I'm actually exploring the ICC and its prosecution of gender crimes because I really believe in its capacity to do so. So do you think that they could learn anything from the ICTY who were successful in prosecuting gender crimes?
Thank you.
You touched upon Iraq, investigation in Iraq, and I believe that last year international ICC have announced that they'll investigate a claim regarding abuse of UK forces in Iraq. I wasn't sure if they dropped it because the UK does have their own Iraq historic alleged team, IHAT, and I believe that UK lawyer has given 400 cases of mistreatment. And you touched upon gender-based violence of women, but what about men and those who are used as a torture, a tactic of torture, and you don't really get a talk much about it.
Mm. Can I just touch base, I'm sorry, at the back, can you hear these questions?
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm sorry, could everyone please speak up? Look at me with this big microphone, but I've got this booming voice. I'm sorry, we don't have a roving mic, but if people could speak up,
yeah,
please, thank you.
Will I do these two?
Go for it.
Yes, okay. ICTY, I mean, that's a really mixed picture too. And actually, I was at a meeting again this week with Michelle Jarvis, yet another Australian who works in international criminal law, who's been a prosecutor there for a long time. And she had just sent to the publisher a 700-page manuscript, which is talking about the lessons learned from the ICTY, what not to do, basically. Because in so many ways, they were trying to work it out. And to some extent they have, but she was saying right up until, you know, these closing stages of the ICTY, they're still learning lessons. The problem, I think, for the ICC initially, they didn't really want to engage with the ICTY and ICTR, including employing their staff, which I thought was a terrible mistake because those people had been on the ground, they'd learnt the lessons, even though they were different statutes. They did not embrace them to the extent that they have begun to do that now. So the ICTY, I think, and the ICTR, you know, did produce some really important breakthroughs, but also some real limitations. But one of the things that's come out of this, a really positive thing, is they've just launched the Prosecutors for Sexual Violence International Network, where they're really trying to come together to develop these skills, to have knowledge sharing, and to engage in domestic settings so that these lessons don't have to be learned over and over again. Like, we know how to gather some of this evidence. We know how to develop these arguments. We can show you where the jurisprudence is, so that we get a more expansive an ongoing sort of sense of development of this area. In relation to the Iraq question, I think this really touches on this challenge for the court. It's seen to be such in such a difficult place because of all the African states. But it's going to be likely that the court's only ever going to end up with these sorts of states that are mostly, if not unwilling, they're unable to do it. Where you've got a case of the UK where it is prosecuting, perhaps not perfectly, but it is undertaking these domestic prosecutions, the ICC can't take on those cases because they have demonstrated a willingness or an ability to do it. So it's very unlikely that the UK will ever appear. It's very unlikely that Australia will ever appear. Any of these, you know, functioning liberal democracies who take those sort of cases seriously are likely not to be seen as admissible. So there is this problem of a sense of victor's justice going on here, and that it's only going to be, you know, poor, undeveloped countries that are going to be hauled before the court, which leads to this discourse around neo-colonialism and neo-imperialism and so on. But that's what the principles of complementarity actually mean. The inability and unwillingness is core to that. So long as the UK keeps on with these processes, it's very unlikely that they'll come before the court.
Yeah, focused on the front. I'm going to the naughty kids in the back. Yeah, you and, sorry, with the black shirt.
Okay, excellent. My name is Hilary. I'm a visiting fellow at the Center for Women, Peace and Security. And I'm intrigued by the story of the all-male judges that took the last appointments. And I was just wondering, I'm not familiar at all with how the judges were chosen. So is it that people knew that there were female judges that were also in the running and all got done with backroom deals, or by the time the appointments were put forward, was it just happened to be a slate of all men? I would be interested to whatever you can tell us about that.
Okay.
Hi, Beatrice. I'm not like a lawyer or anything, but just like, of course, I kind of like see like as a human, like ICC, for example, is something that is like a bit less political, like it's supposed to be less political, rather like humanitarian. So what's your like your as a fresh thought, like what do you think of ISIS and like what's going on there with the sexual violence in these countries, and what do you think the ideal role of ICC should be in a situation like this that is like affecting us now, and like to shape the future, of course, because it was done like in the past to shape, like to have a better future. So I don't know.
To go to the judge's question, so they were in a very interesting position in that last round of judging, in that to make sure that the bench was fair in relation to men and women, they had to vote for at least one man, because they'd got to almost 60%, and it was going, if there was too many more women, it was going to, we're being at that tipping point where there'd be too much representation from women, which is unbelievable. So states quickly corrected. It's like, don't worry, we'll resolve this. And I don't think actually in this case it was too many backroom deals. It was just like, oh yeah, we've got them all lined up, you know. And a few women were put forward, but states relished the chance just to instantly vote all the men back in. But it was prior to this election, actually, where noises were starting to be made by the civil society community saying, we're witnessing these old ways of doing things. And it is that thing of, you know, you take your eye off the ball and those things just slip back in. And there was deals about, it was really about climate change. If you support us on that tribunal, then we'll support you on this one. Had nothing to do with the quality of the judges, had nothing to do with anything else. It was just pure international relations diplomacy, you know, as it's always been. So it'll be very interesting to see what happens from now on, because I think, my guess is that most states will feel comfortable with 30%. Isn't that the magic number, Sarah, that we talk about all the time? You know, 30%, we can put up with 30%, and 30% actually looks like women have taken over the world. You know, people always go, oh, my God, it's 30%, you know. It looks like there's so many women around, and it's 30%. So I reckon that's, anyway, watch that space, but I would think that states are comfortable with those numbers. Yeah. In terms of the new start and where the court is sort of going, I was talking to John and Pauline about this the other night, but I think it's a lot to do with setting standards and showing best practice around this and being a standard setter. We're never going to see a lot of cases being prosecuted through that court. And in some ways we shouldn't, if states are doing their job. But when they do undertake these cases, what we do hope to see is they're doing it as well as they can, using an instrument that's, you know, really forward thinking in terms of understanding some of these aspects of the law. It's sort of the best tool that we've got. It's an imperfect tool, but it's the best one we've got. And I suppose this is what I mean about not overburdening the court, not expecting it to do too much, understanding it's going to operate slowly, understanding that it's not going to prosecute too many people, but what we hope happens when they do is that they are very sensitive to all aspects of the statute.
I can't believe we're running out of time. So, yes, can I have you and you? Thanks.
So I had a question about the the aftermath.
Can you speak up? I'm so sorry to ask.
I had a question about the sanctions in these cases. So with Lubanga, kind of the fact that he was put in prison and now wants to do a PhD.
Yes.
And the kind of how that works in terms of victims, like justice for victims, if they know that someone who's done these mass kind of atrocities is going to be able to do a PhD to kind of rehabilitation versus something that's so grave and inhumane that could you let a person like that do a PhD?
It should come to LSE. We've had Gaddafi.
Yes, that's right. Exactly. I didn't think you were allowed to mention that.
It's recorded.
Hi, my name is Echo. I'm a PhD student here at the Gender Institute.
But not, a war criminal.
She's not a lawyer. Not a lawyer.
I'm also not a lawyer, so I'm hoping you'll.
Nor am I. Yeah, so it's okay.
I was hoping to follow up on the question of complementarity and whether there's a. Where do things like truth and reconciliation commissions, traditional forms of justice, do they count? Is there a discussion around that? Is that, you know, a state taking an acceptable action and not deemed unwilling or unable?
Thank you. That's, very good question. So in terms of the sort of sanctions and penalties, this is really controversial. And we may have seen actually one or two of these people handing themselves over to the court because the forces are closing in on them and they think, oh, if I stay here, the death penalty exists. But if I take myself off to the embassy and go to The Hague, quite a pleasant prison, you know, that's sensitive to all sorts of cultural demands, and I'm not going to get the death penalty. In fact, Lubanga got 14 years and he'd already spent 7 of them, so he had 7 to do and wants to do a PhD. Katanga, who was convicted earlier this year, is out. And this is before the reparations process has even been started, let alone completed. So this is a real challenge for the court. You know, what are the appropriate penalties to be applied here? And I think this is another one of the legitimacy challenges for the court, to be seen as sort of soft justice, if you like. Particularly, you know, it's primarily the victims on the ground that are the ones that are really going to suffer. And this language around the court about doing no harm, I think they have to take this very seriously, because I think some of those things do harm. When victims are still waiting, they've been promised something out of the court, the reparations. That they haven't seen any of that, but already the perpetrator is walking free. So it's creating lots of complications. And we haven't even had the chance to talk about this, but I think the design of the statute, where they're trying to bring together that retributive and redress side, is really problematic. If someone said to me, what would you do to make the ICC work, I'd sever those and I'd put reparations and the redress element in a completely different space, like a truth and reconciliation sort of thing, a Sierra Leone case where you've got the tribunal operating separate to a transitional justice sort of measure, because I think these two working together is really problematic. In terms of complementarity, it hasn't been quite resolved how those other transitional justice mechanisms might be considered. Because the inability question is a real one in conflict and post-conflict states. You know, they might not have the capacity to be running, you know, full-blown criminal trials, but they are running indigenous sort of legal, semi-legal processes. One of the issues that's been really contentious is around amnesties, and particularly in the Ugandan case, where a lot of people argued that the ICC frustrated, possibly even broke down a peace process because amnesties aren't possible here, and there's no immunity for anyone, including heads of state. So it's still an open question, I think. And in my view is the general trend of the judges in addressing complementarity is to leave it with the state. As far as they can possibly see that something's being done, for no other reason they can't afford to take another case on. You know, there is a political and budgetary reality that they also have to deal with. But there's not a case being run around an alternative dispute resolution mechanism yet, so we'll see.
We've got time for one more question. We'll take one more. Thank you.
Yeah, just a couple of points. The complexity of looking at gender sort of by itself. Ongwen was a child soldier, if I'm right. Yes. So he himself was conscripted as a child. Mm. Now he's facing 67 charges in this court. His own life story is full of abuse in itself. So that is quite a complex issue, I think. And then just on this point of sort of special treatment for perpetrators. Oh, sorry, I didn't introduce myself, Jenny Cooper. On this special treatment of perpetrators, once I heard one of the prosecutors from the ICTR, I think it was, talking about how the perpetrators in custody were getting treatment for HIV/AIDS and having a healthy life ahead of them, whereas all the kind of people who had been subjected to sexual violence who were still on the ground were dying of AIDS. You know, that's a huge inequality.
Well, you're right on both counts. It's really fraught, isn't it? I mean, the child soldier question is really, really problematic. They're perpetrator victims at the same time, and it's just very difficult to find a way of dealing with this. And the Lubanga case brought that out. And now, you know, 10 years on, those child soldiers aren't children anymore. And they're the ones that are likely to going to be rewarded with reparations. So the communities that were victims of the child soldiers may well witness those child soldiers having some form of reparation for being child soldiers. So, I mean, I don't know. We want defence rights. We want standards being applied in courts of law and that these people should not be mistreated. And if they have serious illnesses like HIV/AIDS, you would hope that they would have treatment for this. But it does create those inequalities, and I don't know, there's just perennial problems. I don't think not having courts involved in these procedures is necessarily going to resolve that, because those inequalities will play out in different ways on the ground as well. And I think that's also an issue around alternative mechanisms. I don't think they're always the answer either. Without the sort of procedural protections that you get in a court of law, that they're necessarily a favourable environment, especially for the sorts of crimes that we've been discussing tonight.
Yeah, I think that's a really poignant question to end on, that notion of the child soldier then becoming the perpetrator, because in the end this is about trying to stop a cycle and embed a culture where actually that's a crime, not a career path.
Yes.
So
yes.
Your book, though, I think is about, and I the reference to Hillary's work and the silences, addressing the silences, this book absolutely finds those silences and addresses them. And we congratulate you on it. Thank you very much, Louise.
And having mentioned Hillary, it remains just to invite you warmly to our next event on the 15th of December, where Christine Chinkin and Hillary Charlesworth will come together,
the gang's back together.
to discuss their groundbreaking work on the boundaries. So that will be at Freshfields. Pre-registration is required. It's a law firm. There'll be great drinks. Now, though, we welcome you to have drinks with us, and thank you very much for coming.
Oh, I so appreciate it.